Construct 2005, Brighton, England. Andy Budd. What is Web 2.0?
Andy Budd is a user experience designer for Clearlift, and he's going to explain what all this Web 2 stuff is about. Okay, over to Andy.
Thanks. Well, first off, I just want to say it's a real pleasure to be here today. It's really great to see so many sort of friendly, familiar faces. So thanks all for coming along and helping us make this sort of first event what it's going to be. Just to give you guys a little bit of background about this event, basically, I've been wanting to put on some kind of sort of grassroots web event in the UK for the last couple of years. I've seen lots of stuff going on in America, from big events like South by Southwest through to very small kind of grassroots events like Nodicon, Barcamp, stuff like that. And I've just really felt that we've needed more kind of web events in the UK to celebrate the community, to share information and knowledge, and just to really sort of represent what's going on in the UK, because the web, despite being global, has a very sort of American-centric view. So I want to bring more kind of community stuff into the UK. Like I say, something I've been wanting to do for quite a while, but setting up a new company, Clearlift, basically the whole conference sort of dropped off the radar, dealing with clients, setting up websites, all that kind of stuff. And then about 2 months ago, Nick from Wired Sussex contacted me and said, well, we're running this digital festival. We have this great venue available for an event. Can you think of anything that we could do? And it kind of seemed like a really good opportunity, an opportunity not to be missed. So I contacted a whole bunch of people, very kindly some of them volunteered to speak, and very quickly, over the space of 2 months, we put the event together. So that was 2 months ago, and here we are now. I'm gobsmacked slightly that we managed to sell out so quickly, and it's just really great to see all you guys here. We're going to be talking today about Web 2.0 and what conference about Web 2.0 would be complete without a discussion about what the term means. And I know there's a lot of heated debate about what it means and whether it's a buzzword or not. So I'm going to hopefully discuss a few of these things. I'm going to discuss what it's about, why it's important. I'm going to show you a few cool sites, and I'm also going to talk a little bit about where we're going to be going in the next sort of 4 to 5 years web development. So is Web 2.0 a buzzword? Well, it is. You know, there's no getting around it. It is a buzzword. There's lots of buzzwords out there at the moment. You know, Ajax, Web 2.0, folksonomies. I mean, web standards is a buzzword. You know, the web is full of buzzwords. That's a fact. However, just because it's a buzzword, there's no reason to write the whole underlying philosophy and methodology off. You know, you might not like the word, call it something else, but, you know, there's no reason to write it off. Buzzwords also, they do have a very real use. They help define quite a complicated and nebulous, in this case, set of concepts. Really easy is communication. If you've got two developers in a room and you say to one of them, oh, I've seen this cool new Web 2.0 app, you're pretty sure the other one's got an idea about what you're talking about. You don't have to go in and explain what it does and exactly how it works. You can just say, oh, it's a Web 2.0 app. Sorry. It's also really good for non-technical people. You know, your sales managers, your account directors, your clients. They don't have to know the underlyings of how these things work. They don't have to understand what Web 2.0, you know, the reality of it means, how it all works, how it all functions on the sort of technical level. But they can use this word to communicate with their developers, with their clients, and you know, it's really, really useful. And I think one of the sort of the biggest things about buzzwords is they're a really good way of promoting technologies. I mean, I can almost guarantee that if it wasn't for the buzzword, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't be having a Web 2.0 conference because we couldn't encapsulate what we're talking about. You look at Ajax. I mean, the technologies behind Ajax have been around for a really, really long time. It's only until they invented the term Ajax that the concepts really started to sort of get attention and get focus. So buzzwords aren't necessarily an evil thing. You might not like the term, but they're still useful. So what's Web 2.0? Well, you know, it's kind of a bit of a Zen thing, really. It's not a technology. It's not a thing. No one's saying it's like, you know, a different set of technologies made up Web 1.0, and then a new set is Web 2.0. You know, that's not what's intended here. It's much more state of mind. It's much more of a, you know, the sound of one hand clapping. It's a very Zen. You either know what it is or you don't know what it is. but that's probably not very useful to you guys. So I'm going to try and help explain what I think Web 2.0 is. To do that, I'm just going to discuss a little bit about how the term came about. The term was invented by Tim O'Reilly and Dale Doherty when they were brainstorming for one of their many conferences, O'Reilly Media. And they saw that many of today's successful web companies shared a very, very similar set of beliefs and characteristics. And these were almost in opposition to the beliefs and characteristics of the old school web companies of 2000. And so they decided that they could kind of mix and match or kind of divide companies up into old school, new school, web 1.0 or web 2.0. So really it was just a handy word, web 2.0, to describe the way that companies are now using the web as opposed to the way they used to use the web 4 or 5 years ago. So here's a sort of some example of what they would have considered web 1.0 companies versus web 2.0 companies. AltaVista versus Google, Hotmail versus Yahoo Mail. This is the new Yahoo Mail beta. I don't know if any of you guys have tried it. It's only open for people in the States, but if you can get your hold of a test address, it's fantastic. It's like a fully featured mail client, but it's on the web. Ophoto versus Flickr, mp3.com versus iTunes. Now, all of these companies on the left are old guard, and they all used to do things in a certain way. They've been taken over by the companies on the right-hand side, and they have a much more different, much more open approach to how the web works. And it's this approach that's made all the companies on the right successful and overtake to a certain extent all the companies on the left. So what are these attributes that these companies on the right have? Well, what makes a Web 2.0 application? For a start, it's about open data. It's about using open data formats, not using proprietary formats, using XML, using CSV, using data formats that everyone can use. It's about not having data lock-in or walled gardens. It was very, very common for the old school of web application. Once they got you in the door and you were using the application, they just wouldn't let you go. They would lock you in to using this service and you had no escape. The new kind of concept really is you know, not locking people in. The users create the data, the users own the data, the users can do whatever they want with their data. You know, they can have it as an RSS feed, they can take it and put it on their site to create some kind of data mashup. They can use their data outside of the application. If they decide that they don't like the application, if they've uploaded all their photos to Flickr or they've uploaded all their lists to Darlist and they don't want to use that service anymore, they can take the data with them. There's nothing locking them in. It's not as though you walk into a shop and they don't let you go until you buy something. You know, the whole philosophy is open data. And I think one of the big benefits is that the data can be used across devices. I don't necessarily mean mobile versus laptop, but just as simple as being at work and I'm using my work computer. I see a bookmark I like, so I bookmark it. If I go home, it's not on my bookmarks. But if I use a Web 2.0 application like Delicious, I can bookmark it on one computer, I can go home, and this data is available to me wherever I am. So it's independent of the device you're using. And I think this is a real powerful thing, that this whole data independence. This is a bit of a buzzword, but this concept of an architecture of participation. Basically what it means is you're building an application that encourages people to participate in whatever means that they can. The fundamental sort of thing about this is people are providing a service, not a product. If you have a web application, you're providing a service. And like all good service providers, the better service you can provide, the more successful your application will be. The architecture of participation, it really encourages user contribution from a lot of levels. For instance, if you look at Amazon, pretty much every page on the Amazon site has some way for you to contribute, be it writing a review, or posting up a wish list, or posting up information about list mania lists. It really encourages users to take part. Again, blogging's been hugely phenomenal, and a lot of the reason blogging's phenomenal is because people can communicate back, people can leave comments, people can feel like they're part of this thing. There's a concept of collective intelligence that basically says that the sum total of the wisdom of a group of people is greater than the smartest individual in that group. And so a lot of applications are built so that they capitalize on this kind of groupthink, this collective wisdom. And if you look at things like PageRank on Google, it uses the community and it uses the web. It looks at who is linking to who and uses that information as ranking. Folksonomies is another one. Popularity, if you go to any website, you can usually, any good website, you can usually rank by popularity. And that's using the collective intelligence of the users to say, well, all my users find this thing popular, so it must be popular. It's a really good way of I was going to use the word leverage, I do apologise, but it's a really good way to use your users and get them involved. The architecture of participation also means that you make it easy for people to use the data to remix it. You look at things like Flickr, you can use this information on your website as a feed, mash it up with other services, and it really encourages the developer community to get involved. Customer self-service is a very, very big factor as well. You want to get your customers and your users actually helping themselves rather than having to do everything for them. The more you can get your users to be involved and to active and help themselves, the easier your life will be as developers. And all of this sense of participation creates a very, very strong community around your product, your service. And the people that use it feel that they own a part of it. They own the data, they want to succeed, and this is an extremely powerful tool. Having a hardcore dedicated set of followers is fantastic. Again, for instance, take Flickr. Flickr have got this amazing API, you can do loads of stuff with it. Probably not of interest to 90% of the users, but that 5 or 10% of techie people, when their mum or their dad or their brother says to them, oh, can you recommend somewhere to share photos? Because these people feel like they belong with Flickr, and they use it, they've got a passion for it, they will spread the word. So having a passionate user base is really important. And finally, a rich user experience. Web 2.0 applications need to be easy to use, they need to be pleasurable to use. They shouldn't be a pain, they shouldn't be a hardship, they should be enjoyable to use. You need to create rich user experiences that are much closer to the experience of a desktop application. And that's obviously where things like Ajax come in. Creating this much more rich application-like experience. So those are the three core things I see as being part of Web 2.0. And I'm going to just show you a couple of cool Web 2.0 applications that I really feel exhibit a lot of these properties. I assume everyone's seen Google Maps here. Google Maps is one of the sort of the first applications that really kicked off this whole Ajax-y Web 2.0 thing going on. It's an interactive map. You can drag and drop. It's got a very, very rich functionality that you wouldn't normally see on a website. And also they have open data, which means that other applications and other services can use this data. And this is what a company called OneMap have done on OneMap. They've taken the mapping data from Google, they've taken house data from wherever, they've mashed it up to create this really, really cool map of England. You can type in a postcode, it zooms in, and it shows you all the houses for sale in that area. This is great for me because as a few people who rang me up this morning asking for directions to Fabrica know, my sense of direction in Brighton is appalling. I don't know any of the street names. So whenever I look for a house and I look at a name of a house and it says it's in this street, I've got no idea where it is. Something like this is really useful because I can now visualize where these houses are. I can visualize which part of town I want to live in. Click on the little icon, it brings up information. This is a really useful, functional, rich way to use sort of the concept of Web 2.0. Netvibes.com, there's been a sudden resurgence in start pages. Everyone seems to have one at the moment. Yahoo's got one, Google's got one, Microsoft is working on one. I think they announced it a couple of days ago. This is just a start page, and the idea is very, very simple. You bookmark it as your start page in your browser, and when you go there, it presents you with customized information. So here I've got a little note to myself. I've got a feed from one of my favorite weblogs. I've got a list of all my unread Gmail. The weather in Brighton from a couple of days ago and a Google search. And obviously as more of these little mini applications, these Web 2.0 applications come about, they'll be able to hook into this and you can collectively bring in all of your sort of disparate bits of information from around the web in one start page. Backpack, I don't know if any of you guys have used Backpack or if any of you have used Basecamp 37 Signals application. Backpack is really cool. It's like a wiki on speed. It's a wiki, but it's got lots of real rich interaction. You can edit on the page, you save, it doesn't have any page refreshes. This is actually a display of a list widget, which you can type in lists, add items, check them off, and it all happens without the page refreshing at all. It's a very, very nice rich experience. Mibu is a fantastic little application. It's actually an IM client online. It covers the four biggest IM clients. It functions like a proper desktop IM client, but it runs in a browser. The benefit of Mibu particularly, there's a couple of benefits. First of all, you don't have to download any software. It's online. So if you're in a company where they don't like you installing software, or if you need to check up your IM clients, you need to talk to someone on a web cafe, then you just go to this web address, type your username and password in, all your buddies appear, they're dragged off the server, you don't have to do anything, all your buddies appear and you can chat away. And it's fantastically responsive. I was actually expecting it to be really slow and sluggish. It's really cool. The other benefit of Mibu is that it works behind corporate firewalls. So a lot of companies will stop people from using iChat or just shut everything down by default. iChat can be very, very useful when keeping in touch with clients. So if you're behind a corporate firewall, then you can use Mibu. And there's actually a story in the New York Times, I believe, of a GI over in Iraq who was using this this product to keep in touch with his family at home because the American army had shut down, put a firewall on all their communications. So Mibu, it's definitely worth checking out. And I know quite a few people who use it or have recommended it to clients that are behind corporate firewalls. Writely is another very, very cool Web 2.0 app. It's basically Word on the web. When I first heard about this, I thought, well, it's not going to be very functional. I've seen kind of Word takes in the past. It'd probably be a bit rubbish. It's really, really good. If you need the functionality of Word, but don't want to pay £300-400 for it, this little application does pretty much all the stuff you need. And the benefit is it's on the web. So you've got two things going on here. First of all, it means that you can start writing a document on one computer. You can go home and pick it up. It's device independent, as I mentioned before. And secondly, it's collaborative. So you can actually invite two or three or four other authors to help you author your document. So if you've got a distributed network of developers, or if you're, I'm currently writing a book at the moment, and if you're dealing with people like a tech editor, I've got my tech editor over in the States, I've got another editor somewhere else, you can actually do things collaboratively online rather than having to shoot off emails and documents backwards and forwards. So Writely is very, very cool. All of these applications rely on kind of a set of core technologies which really kind of make up Web 2.0. Like I said, it's open data through APIs and web services. RSS is a big part of Web 2.0. Ajax, which as we all know is a buzzword for JavaScript and XML. And web standards, DOM scripting or ECMAScript, XHTML and CSS. When I was planning for this talk, I sent a couple of emails to local mailing lists saying, you know, I'm doing this Web 2.0 conference. What do you guys think of Web 2.0? The answer I got back from a lot of people was, well, what's the point? I don't see, you know, it's nothing new. The first steam engine was invented in Greece in the first century AD, and it was used as a toy. It wasn't until 18th century Britain that steam engines were first used to power industry, to power machinery. And it was this use of technology combined with the cultural and economic factors that really led to the Industrial Revolution. It wasn't the fact that steam was new, steam had been around for years and years. It was the fact that people started to use this technology in new and interesting and innovative ways. And I'm not going to be glib and say that Web 2.0 is a revolution, but I think a lot of the similarities hold. You know, these technologies do exist and they have existed for a while, but suddenly we've started using them in new and innovative ways. I think the cultural and economic conditions have changed. I think people view the web in a slightly different way to what they did 4 or 5 years ago. I think we've got a more mature industry. I think we've got a much healthier economy. And I think a lot of companies are just realizing that to stay ahead of the game, to stay in the position they currently have, they need to innovate. You need to constantly be innovating just to maintain your position. And if you don't, give it 2 or 3 years' time, and you know, once your company was at top of the league, and now it's been taken over by lots of people that are innovating. So I do think there is a bit of a revolution going on. I think it's a really exciting time to be a web developer, and I think this is part of the reason why you guys have come along. And I think it's part of the reason why this conference was so popular and sold out really quickly, because suddenly it's fun to be a web developer again. There's a renewed interest and energy on the web. We're seeing new interesting applications popping up literally every week. you know, I know at least two or three or four of my friends, very, very good sort of JavaScript people, have been approached and been snapped up by big companies. These are the Yahoos, the Apples. You know, if you're a developer, if you're somebody that knows Ajax and JavaScript, you're hot property at the moment. And people are investing in startups again. There is, you know, venture capital became a bit of a dirty word, but people are investing in the web now. However, a lot of this activity is going on in the States. I want to see more activity going on in the UK. I want to see more UK startups because we need it. We've got a very, very vibrant web community here. And so it's really important to see a few startups. I know there's a few startups in the audience that are going to launch fairly soon. I've got a couple of, I'm trialing a couple of very, very exciting apps at the moment, which I can't tell you about, but I'm sure you'll hear about soon. But there are starting to appear some very, very cool web startups, but we need more. However, I want to give you guys a word of warning. I am starting to see people make the same mistakes as they did in 2000. Usability, accessibility, and web standards are being thrown out the window now in this rush to get web applications up. You know, all the hard work that the kind of web standards community has done over the past 5 years suddenly seems like it's starting to be ignored in favor of whizzy applications. And you know, you just because you're building an interactive application, it doesn't mean that it can't be accessible. It doesn't mean that you can't think about usability and accessibility. In fact, these things are paramount. So you need to kind of bear this stuff in mind. Don't just try and chuck something up and then fix it later on, because you'll find you never have the time to fix it. A lot of developers particularly see every problem as a technological challenge that has a technological solution. And fundamentally, not everything has a technological solution. I've also seen a lot of people that are creating solutions where there aren't problems. There's a sudden rush of web applications out there that are very, very cool, but are essentially no use to me. People have come up with an idea that's very, very cool, but you know, isn't much use. So you know, these aren't issues to do with Web 2.0 as such. These are business models, business issues. You know, if you're going to create a Web 2.0 application, you need to think about, is there a problem, is there a market? And also you need to think about business models, because again, a lot of people are doing the same old things that they did in 2000. They're putting up an application and think, oh, well, we'll figure out the business model later. That's not good business. And a lot of people are asking themselves, is this just another internet bubble? Well, I personally don't think it is. I think we have a much mature market. Both developers are much more mature, and also clients are much more mature. I think the web economy is much maturer. For instance, 5 years ago, the chance of getting people to pay for subscription service on a monthly basis was pretty slim. Now there are an increasing number of applications that have a very, very active subscription-based business model. Internet advertising through like Google Ads and stuff is also a very, very viable source of income these days. So I think the web economy has changed. I think people have learned from the mistakes of 2000. And I honestly think Web 2.0 offers real and tangible benefits, both for the user and for the developer. But you know, there's a lot of hype going on at the moment. There is a lot of hype, and a lot of people are getting turned off the concept of Web 2.0 because of the hype. You know, get over it. You know, every new technology, every new concept has hype built up around it. When the web first started, there was an inordinate amount of hype. Let's just forget the hype. Let's just not worry about the terminology. Let's not worry about whether you call it Web 2.0 or something completely different. Let's just use the concepts and start to build cool stuff. I think there's a fundamental driving force behind Web 2.0. And I think this is quite critical. The web is changing. And it's changing from a document delivery system to an application delivery system. This might seem like a fairly simple, obvious thing, but it's quite a big deal. Because the web we have at the moment, the technologies we have at the moment, are suited for documents. They're not suited for applications. And so I think it's really important. The web is now becoming a platform. And there's a lot of good reasons why the web is a platform. It simplifies distribution. If you're creating a web application, it's much easier to get it out to people. It's a much easier way of maintaining code. You have one code base you have to look after. You don't have to worry about versions, all this kind of stuff. It means that you can get your products faster to market. You don't need a distribution channel. You can share data across devices, like I said, it was really, really cool. And also, it's a way of moving towards a subscription model rather than one-off purchases. And finally, what's next? Where's the web heading? Well, we've already seen sort of Ajax applications start off in a big way this year. I think next year is going to be even bigger. Ajax is going to be dominating the web, I think. We're starting to see applications move out of the web as well, out of the browser, which I think is the way things are going. You look at desktop widgets like Dashboard and Confabulator. They use the same techniques as websites. They use JavaScript, they use CSS, they use HTML, but they're freed from the browser. And I think we're going to see more applications that have that freedom. Flex is a very, very interesting flash technology, which I believe one of our speakers will be talking about later on today. Open Laszlo is a fascinating technology. I'm not going to go into details about it too much now, but it's basically a application platform. Currently hooks into Flash, but it can equally be used for SVG and other technologies, so it's very, very interesting. Zool, most of you guys are probably using a Zool application at the moment and don't know it, which is Firefox. Zool is like a cousin to XHTML. It's a version of XML that's used specifically for marking up documents. I think we're going to see a lot more, marking up applications. I think we're going to see a lot more application interfaces built in Zool and a lot more internet-enabled applications escaping from the browser. And finally, the kind of 100-pound gorilla in the corner is Microsoft. Microsoft are being very, very quiet at the moment, but they've got some pretty impressive stuff going on. They've built a system called Avalon, which is a user interface system into their next version of their operating system, Vista. And their goal is to get rid of the browser and to liberate web applications from the browser, which is one of the reasons why you've not seen an update for Internet Explorer for quite a while. And the new update's coming out soon, but for a while they decided that the browser wasn't the way forward. Smart applications or smart clients are. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and I think it's very, very exciting. And on that note, I'm done. So does anyone have any questions? Gentleman in the front there.
Yeah, I just wondered where you saw microformats, which was kind of a buzzword a while back, fitting into Web 2.0, especially in terms of open data and decentralized data.
I don't think microformats per se are kind of intrinsically linked with Web 2.0. However, I think microformats have come out from a need. I think the need is that the development of XHTML is stalled. And I think the development of XHTML and XHTML in general, like I said before, is much more geared towards document markup and application markup. And so I think people have started basically hacking XHTML to extend it when the standards bodies haven't been extending it themselves. And so I think what we need to do, if we're not going to all be trounced by Microsoft, I know there's a few .NET developers in the audience, but if you're an open source developer, if we're not going to be trounced by Microsoft, we need to either kickstart development on HTML and CSS and Zool and things like that, or we're all going to get walked over. I think microformats are fantastic. Tantek's a very, very bright guy. I urge you all to come to South by Southwest next year and listen to him talk about microformats. Very, very fascinating. I'm not entirely sure that it's necessarily something to do with Web 2.0, but all these things are sort of intertwined somehow. Any other questions? There's a gentleman in the back there. Oh, I know that person.
You can call me a gentleman, that's fine. It's not a question, I would just like to propose that as Microsoft are possibly planning on ditching Internet Explorer, we should give them a round of applause, because it'll make all our lives much easier.
Any other questions or comments?
I'm concerned about
I kind of got a lot of this stuff from developers when I was pushing CSS, which is, well, how do I convince my IT department, my manager, to use CSS? And my answer to that is, well, why do you have to? If you're a builder, do you have to convince your clients to use one kind of aggregate over another? You just use the best aggregate for the job or the best building bricks for the job. You know, you as developers should go out and build the best web applications you can. And I don't think, if you go to your managers and say, oh, I want to do this cool new thing, they'll think, okay, danger. There might be a bit of a problem here. Let's wait for 5 years and see how this thing pans out. I think as developers, you need to take the lead and you need to start using these things. And just do it little bits at a time. You don't have to go and suddenly change your whole website. But you know, you can add little touches of interactivity and little touches here and there. And when your managers see that, you can go, oh yeah, that's Web 2.0, and they'll go, wow, I like that, give me more. But I think if you flag it up as a problem initially, you know, managers will see it as a problem. Are there any other questions, or should we take a quick 5-minute break and get set up for the next speaker? What? Okay. So some more questions, anyone?
It also helps to sort of spread the word with your sort of peers and things like that.
Yes.
I know, as you'll have seen coming over to Fujitsu Siemens, myself and Ben were very sort of big advocates of standards, and everyone's sort of starting to pick it up now. And so people are starting to bring, for example, Andy and Jeremy Keith in to do more training and to get everyone on the bandwagon.
I think having advocates in companies and in small teams is really, really important. I've been doing a lot of training recently, and what tends to happen is there is an internal team of 5 or 6 people, one of them who is into standards, and he said, oh, let's get someone in to train us up. And from that initial response, and suddenly you've got 5 people. And then when they go and work in different companies, and they become the evangelist, and then there's more and there's more. I mean, there's some .NET magazines out the front of the auditorium, which you're more than happy to take away with you. I'm doing an article or contributing to an article for them for next year, which is what's going to be happening in 2006. And I honestly think that things like standards, I think 2006 is going to be the year of CSS, and it's largely because of individuals who are embedded in a company that are passionate about what they do, and this passion sort of spreads out. But I think if you try and push, you meet resistance. Be a bit more sort of Taoist about it, rather than pushing. Just get people in and show them the cool stuff, and then it will just spread, hopefully.
But a lot of these applications, you've got people are going to be looking after your data for you. How do you feel about the fact that, you know, your documents that you've written that are stored online could suddenly disappear overnight?
It's trust. I mean, trust is a huge issue. There was one very, very classic case, I can't remember what it was now, of a company that did that, they stored information. I think it was like an email client or something. They stored information, they went bust overnight, all your information disappeared. You know, you've got to have trust in the application, you've got to have trust in the people developing it. You've got to have trust that even if these people do go bust, they're going to at least have a website up to release your data. I think trust is one of the, as a designer, I think trust is one of the key issues when you're building an application or website. You know, you need to provide enough trust indicators to your visitors to know that you're a trustworthy site, just things like, contact details, prominent email addresses, all that kind of stuff. And you need to instill trust. But you're right, I think that there is a concern that a lot of these little startups, they might disappear overnight. Hopefully they won't. I guess the approach to take is don't put up any, don't invest really, really critical data into a company that's only been around a couple of months. But something like Flickr, I trust Flickr with my photos, I trust Yahoo with my mail. But I don't know if I'd necessarily trust startup.com with my my bank details. So it's different levels of trust, I guess.
Do you think that sort of agency applications still have to be built so they fail gracefully?
Absolutely. I mean, we're actually going to have a bit of an announcement later on today, sort of revolving around the issue. But yes, there's no reason why they shouldn't. And this is the thing I was talking about before, about people making the same mistakes as they did sort of 4 or 5 years ago. If you're building an application, you should really ideally build it so that it works without the JavaScript. So build it so when you click on a link, it goes to a page, it does something. And then what you want to do is you want to hijack that link and then layer the JavaScript over the top. So if you're browsing a screen reader, or if you're using a browser with JavaScript turned off, it will still work. When you've got JavaScript enabled, you're adding that extra level of functionality. I see JavaScript and Ajax just as I see CSS. It's a layer. It's a presentation layer for CSS. It's a behavior layer for JavaScript. And these things, when you take them away, you should still have a functional application.
The question I've got kind of goes back to something that was said earlier, which is, you shouldn't kind of convince your managers that you need to do these things, but you should just get on and do them. Well, as somebody that is a manager and somebody that runs a web design company, the issue I've got is one with our clients, that as I go to my clients, they say that they want so-and-so website built. And they're entirely happy if that doesn't include application-like functionality and if it doesn't include Ajax and JavaScript and all these things. And they're not going to know any different. And there's certainly, my problem is I have to convince them to pay more money for this extra functionality. That, or I decide to do it anyway, and obviously that cuts into my profit margin. So that's the big problem. Unlike web standards, where I could list out a set of reasons why this is really going to benefit you as a client, with things like Ajax, I'm a bit more unsure about what the selling points are.
I think the benefits are, well, particularly with Ajax, I think interactivity is very important. It gives an extra rich layer of interaction with the site, and it makes it more pleasurable. And if you have a more pleasurable experience, you know, you're going to want to use this service more, you're going to be more wedded to it. So I think providing nicer environments, I mean, it's with design as well, it's exactly the same argument you have with design. You know, a client will come along and they've got a rubbishy website and they'll be like, well, why should I change it? You know, well, you should change it because people react better to well-designed sites. Ajax is just one part of design. It may be not a visual part, but it's a way of designing an application that functions and works better. You know, I think we should avoid spurious Ajax. I think we should avoid chucking bits of Ajax just because it's cool. I think we should do it for useful stuff. I mean, I think, for instance, things like form validation and sending off forms is fantastic. I've seen some great little applications. Or checking passwords, if passwords are in existence. You know, you type in a little password, you click a button, goes off to the server, comes back saying that username's already taken, you know. It doesn't add a whole hell of a lot of time to building this thing. In fact, it probably makes it quicker because, you know, you don't then have to create error pages and well, you should do really, but you know it should make the experience a little bit quicker and it shouldn't cost a huge amount of money. But you know, dealing with clients is notoriously difficult. So if you come up with an idea about how to sell them on Ajax, then please let me know.
I think that's we're coming to the end of that. So thanks to Andy for giving us an introduction.
Thanks.